This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Todd Goddard. He's written a book called Devouring Time, Jim Harrison, A Writer's Life. And it is a full-scale, big biography of a wonderful writer. How are you, Todd?
Doing well, David. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a real honor.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. I know you're on the road. As we are talking, you're out doing book events. Maybe you could, before we talk about the book, just talk a little bit about, you know, what you've been doing. When you go out, what kind of people are coming up to talk to you about the book and Jim? Are you meeting some of his old friends? Are you seeing people who are just fans? I'm just curious.
Sure. I feel like the more the events that take place in places where Harrison had once lived or spent a great deal of time, I'm almost invariably running into people who, at least a few people who knew Harrison or knew people who knew Harrison. And so, for instance, I was just in Traverse City for the National Writers Series, and I suspect half to a third of that room knew Harrison in some way, in one way or another, had run into him or something. But I had a couple people come up to me after the show, and say that I even knew that they knew Harrison already and I knew who they were, but a couple of people just came up and said they knew friends of Jim's and this and that and wanted to introduce themselves. I had the photographer of Jim's book jacket photo for his novel Dalva come up to me and actually gift me a photo, the same photo, that jacket photo that appeared of Jim Dalva. So yeah, definitely running into a lot of people who knew Jim, a lot of people who just were lifelong readers of Jim, big fans of Jim, and a smaller slice of people who just came out because, you know, they were interested in learning more about him.
It's so interesting to me as I was reading the book, and you know, as I mentioned to you before we started recording, I had some bit of a, you know, connection to Jim through his family. But not very close to him himself. But reading the book, I was like thinking about how my experience of him as a reader is different than a lot of other people's who came to him through fiction, even though originally he was and always was dedicated to poetry. And I thought that was something that was really important about the book, that you focused on his, and really, I want to, you know, in a way, thank you for that, because, you know, very few poets develop any sort of readership of any kind. And I think you sort of showed Jim, and we can talk more about his early life, because I think that's really interesting and, you know, important, but that he was so much connected to, devoted to poetry, and that it was his true vocation, avocation, his true heart and soul throughout his life, and never leaving it, to the point where, I'm going to skip to the end now, which was an incredibly evocative scene where he, at his death, was writing a poem. I mean, it's just amazingly perfect for anyone who thinks about writing to, you know, if you're going to die, you want to die doing the thing you love. And, but I thought that it was so many people who knew him only as a fiction writer. His novels and the novellas had such a powerful reach, which in a way I had not fully understood how important he was to so many people. And I think you balanced those two storylines really well.
He has, yeah, his readers, many of his readers tend to be incredibly committed to Jim, to his reading. They mean a tremendous amount to them personally, and have for many, many years for many, many of his devoted readers. And you're right. I'm still running into a lot of people who have only read his fiction. And these people are utterly devoted to Jim and his legacy, and say, you know, I've never gotten to the poetry. And that always astounds me. I get it because, I mean, Jim was so prolific in fiction. I think he wrote something like 12 novels, 9 collections of novellas, basically with almost entirely with 3 each in the collection. And so his fiction, the well of his fiction runs very deep. And of course, I think, as I explain in the book too, a lot of his readers came to him through his nonfiction, because when Jim was in his, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and he was writing poetry, he was absolutely broke because he couldn't make a living on poetry. And he was living on something like $10,000 a year. At one point, his daughter was pitching in her money to keep the lights, the electricity on. Jim knew, enough of his friends were writers, and he had mentors who were writing for magazines, and these magazines paid well then. And Jim started sort of cracked into journalism by writing for Sports Illustrated, like his friend, the writer Tom McGuane. And that started bringing reasonable money in the door. But in that nonfiction, Jim was really broadcasting this unique voice he had for nonfiction that's similar to his voice of some of his characters and things in his fiction, but different. I like to think of it a little bit. It's akin a little bit to the new journalism. Jim had a sort of immersive approach to his journalism and would only sort of circle the subject of the topic that he was writing about. So the stories, you know, he'd write about, say, a fishing contest somewhere in Michigan, and the story would be, it would be about that, but it would also be a lot about, it would be about Jim and his coterie of illustrious friends and adventurers. And people would be drawn to Jim specifically, even much more so than the subject of the article. Jim's personality and his friendships and relationships and his lifestyle and his adventures became the story. And that was incredibly attractive to people who read his nonfiction. And that in turn drew those people to his fiction. And then many of those people went to his poetry as well.
I think his fiction is more directly connected. There's a through line to the nonfiction in tone and voice, more so than to the poetry. I think that if you read the fiction, you can tell you're reading the fiction of a poet. But I think that the voice of the fiction is closer to the voice of the nonfiction in a lot of ways, which is one of the reasons why I think he's so popular he's so powerfully emotive for so many people who read his fiction, that it speaks to them in that deep personal way.
Yeah, and they feel like, yeah, they're not just reading about these characters, but in some way they're also connecting with the author, who, you know, has this presence behind the writing that people are very attracted to. And of course, through all of the fiction and nonfiction, as Jim's bringing all these readers into his camp, he's motoring along, you know, alongside it or beneath it all with his poetry, which was truly his first love and would remain so till the very day he died. I mean, he called it the true bones of his life, his poetry. And, you know, it was a through line through his life. And at times it was a lifeline in his life. Jim suffered from deep depressions, many deep depressions throughout his life. And, despite his sort of his endless stores of humor and sort of jovial, larger than life demeanor, he would sink into these deep depressions. And poetry, time and again, he was often most prolific when he was depressed, and poetry had a way of lifting him out of it. I mean, he would find his way out of the darkness through writing poetry. And so it meant a great deal to him, you know, emotionally, psychologically. But it was, I think he saw it as the essence of his, it was a calling. Yeah, Jim more than once refers to himself in letters to his mother and his father as a disciple of, and it was, he was a disciple of literature, and his calling was poetry. And that was where he found meaning, true meaning in his life.
Well, and I think most poets, many artists feel that it is a calling, you know, and that the work speaks to you if you listen. And I think he was definitely, it was interesting to me. I had not, you know, I knew his poetry pretty well, I had not realized how close he had been to Denise Levertov, which helped me understand a lot more of his early life as a writer. She was, you know, she was a particular person in, you know, in a, there's a lot of poets end up having, I don't want to say mentors in that doesn't mean the same thing, but more like touchstones, people who help them see who they really are and guide them through their, you know, through this previous experience, the generation before. You know, we typically have people who mean a lot to us. And I, you know, Levertov was really important to him.
Yeah, immensely so. She was the first, you know, what Jim would say, you know, real poet, and he'd put poet in all caps, you know, and he wrote this more than once to Levertov. She was his first, you know, the real poet who read his work and commented on it ever, really. I mean, it was before that, it was really only friends and family, and many of them were great readers, but they weren't accomplished in the way that Levertov was at the time. And she was a major figure in the poetry world. And she really took Jim under her wing and mentored him on a macro and micro level. She read his poems. She commented word for word on some of his poems, very, you know, very carefully, challenged him, but then also helped him sort of, you know, taught him about sort of the larger world of poetry and what it took to sort of begin to navigate that with publishers and with publicity and all sorts of different things. So it's hard to underestimate or overestimate her importance to his early development as a poet. And she helped, she introduced him to a lot of people. And I don't think a lot of people know about that relationship between Denise and Jim. I mean, it was crucial for Jim's sort of development as a poet and helped to, you know, usher him into the world of publishing poets at the time.
Yeah. No, and I think after that, he, you know, developed relationships with peers who also helped, as you mentioned, Dan Gerber, who I think was really important to him. But it was also interesting to, you know, that he had this relationship with Denise as a woman, for someone who is so often identified as a male figure, you know, in some ways maybe criticized for being such a male figure, you know, the celebrator of the male experience, you know, in that group that he was in with McGuane and that Hjortsberg and, you know, this whole Western Missoula thing. And well, and then also Key West, which was, as you elucidate, probably, you know, that was like one of these really amazing periods in his life, for better or for worse. Yeah. But it was mostly with guys, you know, in terms of his connections and colleagues, they were male. So that, you know, Denise's relationship stands out. He had many other relationships with women, I know, and you talk about not only his wife, but also his other relationships.
I think that's absolutely right. That's why it's, I think, you know, for many readers, I think it would be surprising that he had this such a vital and important early connection to Levertov. And you're right. I mean, Jim was associated with Livingston, Montana, and sort of the Paradise Valley, just south of Livingston, and then, of course, Michigan. But he was often, you know, he wrote about this coterie of friends, and these friends were men. And you're right, he was reading about, you know, his sporting adventures often in his nonfiction, and that involved his friends, and he would write about them and bring them into the story, and often he was fishing and hunting with them and traveling with them. And yet, yeah, as you mentioned, I mean, I think one of the things I really tried to do in the book was to just bring out how many relationships, important, vital relationships Jim had with women throughout his life, both on a personal level. He grew up with five aunts who were all very strong women and helped tend his grandparents' farm. His mother was a very strong presence in his life. His wife was, of course, as well. But Jim would make, you know, Jim made a lot of important professional connections with women throughout his life. And almost all of his editors were, or many of his editors were women.
That's true. Yeah.
From magazines to publishing houses, And those women became close and close friends with him. And they would, and Jim liked to work with them. He respected them deeply. They were, and they helped to shape his career. They helped to shape his books, and edited his books, and mentored him in some ways. And really, that's another through line throughout the book that I think will be surprising to a lot of Harrison readers, and interesting to people who don't know Harrison already.
No, that's true. I think women editors in that period also were less, I mean, they were beginning to come into the book business. You know, it had been an all male preserve for a really long time. It took a long time before women rose to positions of power in publishing. And it is striking that, that Harrison's editors were mostly female, at that particular time. Yeah. And in, as you point out, kind of ironic given his public persona and, you know, the way his fiction and nonfiction land, it is, I think, a surprise for a lot of people.
Yeah. Many of those women editors had just, you know, fairly recently come into the positions they were holding, as you mentioned. So they were people who had started, you know, at all sorts of different positions in their respective publishing firms, and had worked their way up to editor and senior editor, but they were, you know, relatively new in those positions, and Jim loved to work with them, and they often loved to work with Jim. Jim could be incredibly difficult with his editors over the years, certainly with proofreaders and copy editors and people like that, but also people who he thought were presumptuous and wanted to rewrite him. But many of these women writers, editors, he respected and very much valued what they had to say, and they made important contributions to his work, and Jim would listen to them.
So that's sort of a good segue into asking you about your process in writing this book. You know, this is a big book. It took you many years to write. You had to spend a lot of, I mean, like a good biographer, you had to do a lot of research in firsthand materials, talking to people who knew him, going to the places where he grew up and lived. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what attracted you to writing a novel about Jim Harrison, aside from the fact that he's an incredibly interesting guy and a really good writer. I mean, a really good writer.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big reason for me. I was turned on to Jim in college and I read Legends of the Fall first. Someone had turned me on to that book, and I got hooked on Jim and his voice and his style, and began reading all through his fiction, and then went to his poetry and then his nonfiction. And so Harrison always sort of loomed in the back of my mind, with a small collection of other authors, as just someone who had been very influential to me and very early on. And I was simultaneously very interested in writing biography. I'd studied with a few biographers at New York University who were mentors to me. And so, you know, many, many years later, I knew at some point I wanted to take a shot at writing a biography. And when I finally got myself into a position to write one, Jim's name sort of leapt to mind. Now, part of that was a few years earlier, I'd read about Harrison's collected papers being moved to Grand Valley State University outside of Grand Rapids in Michigan. And I remember thinking at the time, I said, oh, wow, you know, Harrison, what a great subject you would make. And what attracted me so much to him was, of course, the quality of the writing. And I thought he was a very important writer. But I love that Jim was just so rich and multifaceted as a subject. You know, poet, novelist, novellist, food and wine writer, screenwriter.
Right, film writer too. Yeah.
Yeah, film writer. I mean, he spent years and years in Hollywood. He was close friends with Jack Nicholson and a lot of other people. Spent a lot of time in Hollywood. He had the whole Key West sort of fabled time that he spent in Key West with a very young Jimmy Buffett, who was just starting out, would sing on the beach with a tin can at his feet to just collect change, right? Tom McGuane, all these other people who would go down there and fish. So I love that he had all these different facets. You know, he had the hunting and fishing and the outdoor thing. He had food and wine. He had the literature, of course. He had Hollywood. And he had lived in a lot of different places. And I loved that he was so multifaceted, and I felt like I would have a lot to write about and a lot of stuff that I felt connected to. You know, I love to fly fish, and I love fruit and wine. And so there was a lot of things that I felt. And I also just felt like I had a connection to Harrison. It wasn't a decision that I struggled over. I didn't say, I know biographers who spend, you know, months and months agonizing over choosing their next subject. And Harrison was never like that for me. The second I sort of got myself into a position to write one, I had remembered reading about his papers, and I said, I'm going to go after this. Harrison, absolutely. It was very organic for me. And then it was just a matter of getting to know the family and getting their permission to, you don't need permission to write a biography, but I really wanted the support of the family, and I wanted the support of his friends to be on board with this project. And so that was my next step. And once I, and no one else appeared to be writing it, which was another thing that astounded me. I could not believe it, that no one had written a biography and that no one had one underway. And so things fell in place for this book. I would say, remarkable ease. The family was willing to work with me, and I got to spend time with them, and hopefully, I'd imagine gain their trust to some extent. And Jim's lifelong assistant, Joyce Harrington Bailey, who was and is still the executor of the estate, was another person I needed to get to know. And so it was a process of sort of opening doors and going through those doors, but choosing the subject, getting this underway, was never an issue for me. I just knew Harrison was the person.
Did you realize how much work it would be and how long it would take you to do when you were beginning the process?
Absolutely not. And so that's a whole nother facet. So if beginning it was easy, getting through it was not. I joke that once I got the book under contract and got a modest advance to get started doing the research, that was a moment of some terror because I realized,
yeah, now you're in it. You got to do it.
I realized it was really beginning to dawn on me just how much work I had in front of me. And it seemed to me that the only way out was through it. And at that time, it seemed titanic. And it was titanic. There's no way around it. But I had the contract. I'd already spent a portion of the advance. There was no backing out, and the only way through it was to do it.
Well, but you could have cut corners and done something much smaller. I mean, if you had less courage, you would have gone in a different direction. I think what you did, and I give you some credit for that, is, you went back to the beginning and you've told his entire story from beginning to end, in a pretty exhaustive way. Not exhausting to us, but exhausting to you, no doubt. That's pretty impressive. And as a reader, I think many, people will come to this in different ways, I'm sure, with different approaches and different understandings and different concerns about his work. But you will learn a huge amount about this guy that you thought you knew. I thought I knew him in a certain way or knew about him in a certain way. I learned a lot more from reading your book. And it is pretty rich. Again, I knew something about his early life, and I'd known a little bit about his family. But there are things that happened in his life that were really important that probably most of us don't know about. And, there's wherever you come into it. I mean, I sort of lost track of him when he did the Hollywood thing. That was kind of, I was either doing other things or I didn't really care. So I learned a lot there too. And, it's just different parts will resonate for different people, I'm sure. But it's pretty, it's a whole life. So there's a lot there.
Yeah. I mean, that terror, it didn't, I knew I was, I needed to go through the whole book, but I also, you're right. I mean, and I thank you. I wanted to, there was a certain kind of book I wanted to write, and And maybe that's what was so scary, because I just knew that to do what I wanted to do was going to take a tremendous amount of work. And that was, you know, not cut corners and do as full of life and full of story as I could. And that was, you know, an incredibly intense research or required a tremendous amount of research to sort of get at what I wanted to get at. But, you know, I also say that it was terrifying, but it was, you know, much of the book was a lot of fun to write. You know, spending time every day in Jim's world,
right,
which was so rich and so full of joy. And, you know, he had, of course, moments and deep periods of darkness, but much of it was, you know, so full of life. Jim, an exuberance and curiosity and beauty. And I felt very privileged often to, you know, be able to get up in the morning and sit down and start reading his correspondence with close friends and or rereading his works and thinking about them in relation to life, you know, and I'm still in that world to this day right now. But there will come a time when that begins to taper off, and that'll be unusual. I've spent so much time with Jim now in his world, interviewing and spending time with his friends. And overall, I look back on it and I think it's been a tremendously fun and joyful and rich experience for me. And so, yeah, there was terror at the work involved, just how much had to be done. And that was certainly true, but much of that work was incredibly rewarding for me.
So do you feel now that this makes you a biographer in a, you know, obviously you are, it does make you a biographer, but what I mean by asking that is, do you think of writing another biography, or do you think next of writing something that's more about a specific, more narrow subject? Because you could go in either direction. You know, you could go from writing a large biography to writing another large biography, or what I could imagine could be interesting would be to focus on something smaller and explore it just as deeply.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of grappling with that now. You know, I could imagine doing a lot of different things, that, you know, and I'm toying with subjects, sort of circling around a variety of subjects, but I've thought about writing a group biography, which I think would be a very different experience. And maybe not, you know, a cradle to grave group biography, but a slice of life or a slice of time biography that circles around a group of people. And so I've toyed with that for sure. I think I am going to stay in the biographical genre, and I'm not quite sure just yet exactly what my next project's going to be. But I do feel like, you know, a lot of this was a learning experience for me. I've spent so much time in the genre that I kind of want to see what I can do with a new book, another biography. I don't know if I'll do another biography after that one, but I have another one in me for sure. And there are people I really want to write about and groups of people I really want to write about. And so now it's been a matter of sort of having all the things line up that I would like in place to write one. And that, of course, includes sort of, you know, is there an archive or the papers and documents that will allow me to write this? And if not, you know, do I feel like I can write it without them? You know, are there enough people to interview, and are they willing to be interviewed that I can actually get the book done? And now that I've written Harrison, I feel, you know, I want another, I'm a little spoiled. I want a subject that's going to be fun and multifaceted and as rich as Jim. And that's not easy to find. So,
yeah, that's for sure. No, I could see that. What I was just thinking about as you were talking about this, the archives, you know, you think about Jim in his life, he was a writing person. You know, he wrote letters. Now I'm wondering if for people younger than him, the research will be different. I'm sure biographers think about this and talk about it all the time, but, you know, the richness of a written history, a written archive, it's different from a digital one. And collecting letters, which, you know, a lot of writers in the 60s and 70s and 80s were writing lots of letters. Now we're still writing, but they're all email and they're ephemeral and much harder to keep track of. Like, not every writer you know, when you, sometimes you give up a computer and your archive goes away, or you, you know, the hard drive is gone. And I'm wondering what that's going to be like in terms of just the idea of biography. How will that work?
Yeah. And Jim was already pretty old school. He never wrote on a computer. He didn't even type. He would handwrite his books.
Oh, that is amazing to me.
Which is amazing. Yeah. And he had people then go and type up what he'd handwritten. And a lot of his correspondence, most of his correspondence was handwritten. Some of it was typed. And in the later years, he would send a lot of emails. Actually, what he would do is his personal assistant would often take dictation, and Jim would handwrite his emails even, and then she would type his emails. So in his archives, you often see Jim's handwritten version and then a typed version of the email,
right,
both side by side. And so Jim was old school. And you're right, it's going to be a challenge for biographers and historians to deal with archives of and stories of people who, you know, either didn't write as often and as much to friends and other people, but also those people who wrote, you know, whose lives were more digital. I think I read somewhere that Salman Rushdie dedicated his hard drive is in an archive, an early hard drive of his.
Right, which then, of course, requires having the equipment to download and access, you know, it. Yeah, it's sort of like musicians with tape and, you know, or like, yeah, I've had some experience with archived material because my father was a writer and he did audio interviews with a lot of people that were on cassette tapes. And yeah, the university library would love to have that, but you got to make sure that somebody has a cassette drive and that the cassette tape survives. So there's going to be, floppy disks and micro disks and all this stuff. Tough. And the same thing I would imagine true for photography with digital, the archival materials, it's going to be a different experience. You know, and maybe AI will save everyone because, in fact, keeping track of and searching through that many bits of material is going to be eye strain. I mean, you know, reading on paper is hard work when you're doing research, but it's much warmer than reading on a screen. And I think that's another issue, too. Like, just the amount of reading and research you had to do for this book, pretty impressive, but on paper. And reading that stuff on screen, I think you would die.
I can't even imagine doing it on screen. Yeah, it's much warmer, easier on the eyes, and more. But I can do it in a variety of locations, and it's much more pleasant. You're right. I mean, the research experience is going to add, and is already, and has been for a while, adding all of these new layers of complexity potentially to the research process that involves all sorts of, you know, like you mentioned, you're going to need all sorts of technology. To just be able to play technology of years gone by. And so sorting all that out is going to be complex. And of course, I think too, I think a lot of people's digital lives, unfortunately, I mean, if you're lucky, that digital life survived, right? And a lot of that digital life has been deleted or gone in a flash by people, even family members, well-intentioned people, who just don't think of that material as archivally relevant. And it, you know, it may or may not be at the moment, but it may be in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years later, incredibly relevant to the research process. And I've already encountered that, you know, in lots of different times where people have deleted years and years and years and years of emails just in a flash. You know, they shoot your countdown and it's gone. Poof. And they might not have done that had they been letters. They seem the more tangible. And
although there are always those stories of writers who instructed their spouse, burn everything when I die, or, you know, throw away that, you know, I don't want that anymore because I'll be gone, not thinking about all of us left behind who want to, you know, and it gets you into the whole question of, you know, should art, does art need to survive in order to be art and all that? You know, there are lots of, you know, philosophical questions, but from a researcher's point of view, you have, you know, you hate that husband or wife who said, yes, I'll burn your archives for you when you die.
Yeah, maybe there was a little more intentionality there, though. You know, it was burn this.
Right.
There was a bit more conscious deliberation about what was taking place. And I think sometimes, more often than not, people just pull the plug on a life full of correspondence online, never even realizing what it is that they're doing.
Right. It wasn't the intention of the creator at all. Right. It was, you know, it's just, oh, here's some stuff to throw away. You know, we don't know what that's going to be.
All right. University of artist or writer works at a university, and university just shuts down their email account.
Right.
And, you know, 20 years of emails. And that was the body of significant correspondence that person had used just goes up.
Yeah, that's actually, yeah, kind of terrifying how much of one's life is so dependent on others in this environment.
Yep.
And on other systems that one has no control over. Whether they're, it's mechanical or digital, on being, I mean, it might even not even be purposeful. It can be accidental, or it can be a catastrophic loss of, you know, you're in the middle of saving your files and then the computer dies and people don't know how to get the stuff off the hard drive, or, you know, or it's burned up in a fire. I mean, just so many ways.
Jim was lucky enough to have his brother, John, whom I know you know or knew, who was a librarian and head of libraries at various universities. He recognized very early on and thought that Jim was going to be a very important writer and a significant writer, and urged Jim over and over and over to keep everything that he had, his, you know, carbons and copies incoming correspondence, and to keep track of that and put it in boxes and save it, and then would, you know, urge Jim's assistant to do the same. And so Jim's archive is incredibly rich and full. Hundreds of boxes of correspondence and diaries and journals and all sorts of things that Jim was compelled to collect, often at the impetus of his brother.
Oh, that's great. He's lucky to have a librarian in the family, especially
right.
An academic research librarian who knew better.
Yes.
Listen, I want to really thank you for doing this. It was great talking to you about the book. It was great getting to know you. And I loved reading this book. It was fantastic.
Thank you so much, David. That means a lot to me. I really appreciate it.
This has been Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Todd Goddard, whose book is called Devouring Time, Jim Harrison, A Writer's Life. It's a terrific book. I really recommend it. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you so much, David.